Gloria Steinem was a co-founder of Ms. Magazine and is now an editor and regular contributor to the magazine. She also co-founded New York Magazine and was its political columnist until 1971. Gloria Steinem's career as a journalist and writer actually extends back to the early 60s, and many of her early and more recent essays appear in her first book, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, which has just been published in paperback by Plume. The book includes pieces on her undercover experience as a Playboy bunny, to research the piece she wrote on that, profiles of Richard Nixon, Pat Nixon, George McGovern, Marilyn Monroe, and Linda Lovelace, and essays on eroticism versus pornography, portrayals of women in the media, and the politics of transsexuality. We'll be setting aside part of this hour for your phone calls and for any questions or comments you may have. Our number is 923-2774, and I ask you not to call just yet, but we should be opening up our lines in 10 or 20 minutes or so. And also, Gloria Steinem will be appearing this evening at a book signing at Encore Books on the University of Pennsylvania campus. That store is located at around 38th and Walnut, and that will be from about 6 to 7:30 for that book signing. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
To Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I'd like to start out by asking you about Geraldine Ferraro. She has called herself a phenomenon in many ways since she's the first woman to be running on a presidential ticket. What do you think she's had to learn in order to become a presidential candidate or vice president, part of the ticket?
Mm-hmm. I suspect it's a bigger national version of what she must have had to learn to be the first woman wherever she was. She was one of the few women in law school, certainly one of the few older women at that point because she had been at home while her kids were young. She, I think, was the first woman prosecutor in that office. And she was, of course, assigned to, you know, rape cases and family violence cases and so on, and attributes a great deal of her learning about the real situation of women to that experience. But mainly she was, if not the only, one of the very, very few female prosecutors. And, of course, one of the few women in Congress, especially running from her constituency. I think that she is the first woman to represent her working class, quote, Archie Bunker, unquote, though she always says that she is representing Edith, that it was Edith who elected her. And she won with some overwhelming re-election percentage, I think 85 or 90%. So clearly she did it well. And the experience of being the first and the only is frequently an experience of having to be exemplary, which is a kind of tyranny in and of itself, because the judgment of you is transferable to your group. This makes no sense, of course, but it is, in fact, what happens, that the first insurgent from a particular group is treated as exemplary, and therefore the burden of being looked at all the time is enormous and must be really grueling at a national level.
Well, in some of your previous essays, which were based on your travels with other presidential campaigns, such as Nixon's and McGovern's, you discuss the metamorphosis that you detected among these people who were turned into presidential candidates. Do you think that Geraldine Ferraro will be undergoing a similar metamorphosis or is being given advice on what to become to be an appropriate candidate?
I don't know what advice she's receiving, but I have a general sense that she would be best off if she remains true to herself. In the case of McGovern and McCarthy and Nixon, their metamorphosis was a stylistic one. I mean, literally, in McGovern's case, that he changed from short socks to long socks and started to use a sun lamp so he didn't always, you know, look slightly ill. And, you know, it was a kind of Hollywoodification. And there's nothing wrong with that, and some of it is important, at least to the degree that it is an accurate reflection of who you really are. You know, if you have the wrong style and you're misrepresenting, you need to change that. But I think Ferraro's strength comes from her maintenance of her populist style and the fact that she knows what it's like to shop in the supermarket as well as to be a lawyer and a legislator, and she has a gift for expressing complex issues in simple ways, even when they're difficult. I remember a story of her in her first congressional campaign when her very right-wing opponent was making a large point of the fact that her children, her son at least, went to a private school, though she was campaigning on the issue of more money for public schools. And he distributed a flyer, a very pernicious kind of flyer, to an audience to whom she was speaking, and it could be seen as a legitimate inconsistency in some sense. And Ferraro just handled it by standing up and said, you know, many of you received this flyer on your way in, and so I would just like to ask you, how many people here have children? And most people raised their hands, and she said, how many of you would like them to have more opportunities than you had? And they all raised their hands, and she said, well, that's why my son goes to the school that he goes to, but it doesn't mean I don't care about the public school. And with, you know, just those few sentences, she dispensed with an entire issue. She has that kind of gift, and I hope she keeps it and does not try to use a lot of words that end in T-I-O-N and obfuscate in the traditional political way.
Do you think that she's had to consider such stylistic matters as dressing? Such, you had pointed out that George McGovern had to change his sock style.
I don't know the answer to that, but I'm not inside her head. But from what I know from observing her, she has remained. I guess the constituency she represents and the person she is means that she is not a person who would normally wear pants or jeans. She wears simple dresses, and she has been true to that style. And I know that after she had been nominated at the Democratic Convention and went to Fire Island, where her summer house is and where she lives very near an editor of Ms. and her family, who's known her for many years, she came back, Letty, our editor, came back to the office and was exclaiming over the fact that there was Jerry striding down the beach with her kids in very old shorts that had oil stains on them and just the normal old clothes she wears by the ocean, walking very fast as she enjoys doing for exercise. The press was having a terrible time keeping up, and she was saying, well, look, this is my pace. I mean, you want to cover me, you'll have to cover me. And she was wearing the same clothes. So I think thus far she's stayed true to herself.
It seems that the press was thrilled with her appearance initially, and it was an exciting event. But that now she's getting a very, very critical eye because of the questions about her tax returns and campaign financing and so forth. What do you think about her treatment, the treatment she's gotten from the media?
Well, I think the initial treatment was heartening in two ways. First, that it proved what we have been saying, I mean, women and men who care about equality, you know, have been saying to politicians for at least a dozen years, and that is that a good woman on the ticket is not only not a minus, but can be a plus. And I think there was a legitimate outpouring, and is a legitimate outpouring, of enthusiasm. It's the only interesting thing about the campaign. It's the first evidence of politics. Because I am accidentally recognizable as part of this change, I get treated to all this in the street. You know, people come up and say, isn't it wonderful? And I'm going to vote for the first time in 15 years. And, you know, just incredible enthusiasm level. And that's good and sincere, I believe. The second good but insincere response is that reporters and critics and other politicians who really don't think she should be there, who really have a profound unease with a woman in that position, or her in particular in that position, were afraid to say so because of the change in the atmosphere and the sensitivity to sexist comments and, you know, the general pro-equality feeling, at least at the sort of average person's level. And so they were forced to be at least duplicitous and, you know, not say, why isn't she home with her kids? Why doesn't she use her husband's name? You know, we can't have a woman because she couldn't press the button for the atom bomb. I don't know, all these things that they might have been feeling and have said under other circumstances. That displaced hostility or anxiety, I think, has found a home on the tax issue, because it's a theoretically gender-free issue and it's safe to be critical.
But it is a gender-free issue. Don't you think a male candidate would get the same type of examination by the press?
No. First of all, most people would not know who the male vice president was. When I left in New York yesterday, there was a reporter in the street asking who the vice presidential candidate with Reagan, who's after all been there for 4 years, was, and most of the people didn't know. Ferraro may be one of the few vice presidents people identify. So at a simple level of attention, because she's a woman, there is a sharper and a brighter focus on the detail of her life. In addition, women don't generally have access to the same kinds of financial resources Some do, but most don't, and she doesn't. Therefore, she had to raise her campaign money from friends and family and ran afoul of campaign rules for that reason, something that Bush, who, you know, with to use a parallel, who has an enormously well-to-do family and has all this money and a blind trust and so on, would not have been so subject to. And thirdly, most men who have been in political life don't have women as wives who are more active economically and in a professional sense than they are. Most women do. So there's a whole added area of vulnerability here in the sense of responsibility for your spouse's actions that she has, especially, and that many women candidates do have. I don't mean to say that she is not responsible for her actions or her judgment. On the contrary, what women want to be and what feminism is talking about is taking responsibility for her actions. She should not be free from criticism in any sense. That would be truly paternalistic. And she did make some errors. But relative to what? I mean, you know, they, as a couple and she as an individual, have paid a much, much greater percentage of money in taxes than almost any well-to-do people I've ever heard about, you know, 20-30%. And you read every day about corporations that are paying nothing or multimillionaires that paid $150. You know, they really paid an enormous amount. She made an error of judgment on her campaign financing. Her husband made an error of judgment on taking the loan, but apparently she didn't know about that. I don't know, you know, what else is coming up. But at the moment, it seems to me that she should have quieted and even turned around the criticism by showing that they really have been much more responsible taxpayers than most people in their bracket.
How do you think that the Republicans will be trying to get the women's vote? Last night was an initial demonstration. Two of the three major speakers were women. But how do you think more substantively they'll go after the women's vote?
Well, in addition to the cosmetic effort of, you know, putting, as you point out, women into the limelight, which in itself, you know, is a good sign. I mean, because at least they're responding to pressure, so it's a tribute to the pressure. And I'm glad to see that, though clearly what women want is not jobs for four women, but changes in legislation and policy that aid all women as a group, and the Republicans are absolutely not doing that. Other than that, they are making the argument that, just as they make the argument that what's good for the rich is good for all of us, you know, be nice to rich people and they'll be nice to you, it's sort of what is good for the general economy, quote unquote, whatever that means, is good for women. It's a kind of parallel argument that they're trying to make. The fallacy here is that the nature of the pie is only one question. How it's sliced is a very crucial question. And I think we've seen many circumstances, the Depression and the mood now on Reaganomics and so on, which demonstrate that Americans are willing to put up with even privation if they have to, if there's a good reason for it, providing that it's evenly distributed. There's some sense of fairness. And it is the fairness issue that is Reagan's greatest problem, or at least along with the question of his foreign policy and general hot-headedness in the military. I hope that women don't fall for this notion that because General Motors is doing well or better, you know, so are they. The fact is that there are many more millionaires since Reagan took office and many more poor people.
What is your analysis of what at least what the planks are of the different the Democratic plank and the Republican plank of what really offers, you know, the solid pros and cons for women in there?
Well, the most publicized one, I suppose, is the Equal Rights Amendment. All previous Republican administrations and Democratic administrations had supported the Equal Rights Amendment. Reagan, for the first time, who is not, I think, a true Republican in the sense of representing the majority views of Republicans. He's a right-wing extremist who actually used to be a Democrat. I mean, you know, the Democrats have to take some blame for this guy, too. The Republicans are saying we don't think women should be equal under the Constitution is certainly a fairly fundamental difference. Then there is the support by the Reagan platform of the Human Life Amendment, which would criminalize abortion, equate it with murder, even in cases of rape or incest. I mean, look at that plank. You know, nobody's highlighted this on television, but even in cases of rape or incest, a woman and a physician or anybody who aided her would be accused of murder if they help this woman to have an abortion. It's outrageous. Whereas the Democratic platform talks about reproductive freedom. It's not pro-abortion. Nobody's pro-abortion, but it's simply saying that people have a right to decide whether and when to have children, to have access to good medical care, to have children, family planning, safe and legal abortion, and so on. Then there are many other differences in terms of affirmative action and social programs and so on, which doubly affect women because women and kids are mostly the recipients of social programs, and women are mostly the workers in social programs. So when it's cut, they both lose jobs and lose benefits. There are many very tangible differences.
Do you think that the Democratic platform solidly recognizes that connection between women and children and social policies?
Yeah, I do. I'm not overselling platforms in general. You know, platforms are like, I've learned over the years in trying to get, you know, women's issues and other issues into platforms, that if you don't get something into the platform, it's a defeat. If you do, it's not necessarily a victory. You know, it's kind of strange situation because it isn't going to make it real. On the other hand, if it isn't in, even at the level of rhetoric, you're in even more trouble. And it is a statement of intention, and there is an enormous difference. I find it very tough to believe that any woman who is not a masochist who reads both those platforms won't get out and work against Reagan very hard.
My guest is Gloria Steinem, and if you'd like to phone in, our phone number is area code 215-923-2774. That's 215-923-2774, and we should be opening up the phones in a couple of minutes. The Republican platform has been noted for being extremely conservative, perhaps more conservative than the White House had planned upon, and that there are a number of young conservatives in the party, and that the Republican Party, at least, may very well stay conservative for a number of years, perhaps another 20 years or so, because of the youth in the party. How do you see women fitting into this young conservatism?
Well, I don't get this sense. I know what you mean, but if you look at the composition of the platform committee, it wasn't filled with young conservatives. It was filled with people who were controlled by the Reagan administration. So maybe you know more than I do, but I don't think that they were forced to accept stuff in the platform that they didn't want. I think this is the platform that Reagan wanted. It was fairly controlled.
Well, the platform has been noted for being extremely conservative.
Well, just under Reagan, though. I mean, you know, other than that, it hasn't been. And there are a number of people in the party who are now leaders. I mean, for instance, or who are positioned to become leaders, Senator Packwood from Oregon, for instance, and many others who are Elliot Richardson, who's running for the Senate in Massachusetts. I mean, there's a whole raft of people who represent the mainstream of the Republican Party. And there are a lot of Republicans like Betsy Griffiths, who wrote a piece in this week's Newsweek, who is a Republican who feels totally disenfranchised by the anti-woman position that her party has taken. So I think it could change. The party could change. What seems to have happened historically is that beginning in 1964 with the Goldwater nomination, a right-wing extremist part of the Republican Party, many of whom, like Reagan and Jesse Helms, used to be Democrats, but, you know, then the Democratic Party got too integrated and democratic for them and so on and left, took over the levers of power of the Republican Party. But they do not, on most or many issues, represent most Republicans. For instance, Republicans are more likely, statistically speaking, to be pro-choice on abortion than Democrats. But you would never know that from the platform. And there are many such parallels. And I believe there was a poll taken on the nuclear freeze that found that even most of the delegates at the convention in Dallas support the nuclear freeze, but you'd never know that from the platform.
Among the population, do you feel that women voters are part of what is considered to be a conservative trend in American voting?
No, and I don't think there is a conservative trend in American voting either. If you look again at the public opinion polls, the majorities by which measures of sex and race equality, skepticism about military spending and military adventurism abroad, and whatever test cases you want to take, the support has increased from, say, maybe 40%, 10, 15 years ago to 50, 60, and even 70% now. what has happened is that the right wing feeling endangered, the ultra-right wing feeling endangered by the fact that they, in fact, are no longer the majority, are no longer the mainstream, are now in backlash, you know, and are very strongly organized and vote in much greater numbers. The Right to Life organization nationally claims that 90% of its members vote. The Moral Majority claims to have 9,000 or 8,000, I've forgotten, fundamentalist Baptist churches with a card voter operation and everyone and church buses taking people to the polls. Well, you know, that gives them what is a diminishing percentage of people an undue influence. I think probably that if, say, I think it's fair to project that if 60% of Americans voted, there would be no more Ronald Reagan. If the same percentage of Americans had voted in 1980 as voted in 1960, the Nixon-Kennedy race, which was a much bigger turnout than we've had since, there wouldn't have been a Ronald Reagan in the first place. So the question is, will we turn out and vote in large numbers? That is the single most important question. And I hope very much that everybody listening is not only planning to vote, but to get 10 of their friends and neighbors out to vote. That really is absolutely crucial.
Well, let's get to the phones now. If you'd like to call, our number is area code 215-923-2774. My guest is Gloria Steinem. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Gloria?
Yes?
This is Jane Seaman out of your past.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine. I wanted to ask you, to what extent have wives of presidential or vice presidential candidates had their financial records exposed if a joint return had not been filed?
Well, that's a good question, because actually this set of rules about financial disclosure is relatively new. I think that it came out of Koreagate.
Oh, I see.
So we're dealing with a set of rules which theoretically apply to everybody but are new enough so that we don't know what the background of it is. For instance, Congresswoman Mikulski from Maryland was telling me that the question of what means benefit, you know, that you can claim a spousal exemption if you don't have knowledge of or benefit from your spouse's business, has never really been defined. Now, you know, if you live in the same house and you both drive the same car, are you benefiting? You know, there's a lot of murky territory here.
Mrs. Bush has been examined?
Not to the same degree, partly because it's new, but you're right, I think.
He's a candidate again. Can't we go at that again now?
Oh, you mean on what is Nancy Reagan?
No, I think that was a joint return, as I recall, with Reagan, but I was wondering if Mrs. Bush had filed a return as of this current
campaign. I see. Yeah, that's an. I don't know the answer to that, but his considerable holdings are in a blind trust, and
maybe she has considerable holdings.
Yeah, I don't know whether that means her holdings or not, but that's a good question.
Yeah, I think we ought to explore it.
Yes, I do too.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon. I'm descended from a long line of old-time suffragettes, and in those days, even as today, the worst enemies that progressive women found were women. And I wonder if Ms. Steinem has found the same thing. And judging by the call she got on the Maxine Schnall show, I should say it was. I think there are an awful lot of roadshow schlafly's around.
Well, I'm real glad to hear your voice, and probably if I met you earlier, I would have been smarter much younger. It took me till well past 30 years old to figure anything out, and I thank you for all the, for being on the front lines for such a long time.
Well, I'm a mere young chick of 76, but my heart's in the right place.
Yes, not but, and. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
let me say that I think that even if women wanted to be their own worst enemies, they couldn't be because they don't have that much power. And, you know, by and large, it isn't women who have the power to employ other women and thus are not giving equal pay. And it's not women who are the representatives in the legislatures or in Congress or the Senate and are not representing women's issues. So on the pure question of power, I understand what you mean, and it makes me as heartsick as I'm sure it does you when you see women acting against their own self-interest. But But I think we have to keep directing ourselves against where the power is and not get distracted by what Florence Kennedy used to call horizontal hostility, that is, you know, contending with each other. The second thing is that I think, you know, maybe coming from a line of suffragists, you were smarter younger, but I went through the stage, and I think lots of women go through the stage of feeling, of accepting society's assessment of us. You know, you feel that you are from a second-class group, and thus your only way of advancing in the world is to become accepted by the powerful group. And in order to do that, you put down your own people, you know. And that's something that happens not just to women, but to Black people and Jewish people and anybody, any group that's been taught that they're second class. I guess I sort of feel that the miracle is that given all the training and second classness and lack of confidence and guilt and self-blame and passivity and so on that women get, that the miracle is that we've come out of it as much as we have.
Well, don't forget that those enemies of my relatives were completely forgotten. No one can mention a Schaffling name of 1915. On the other hand, the people that my relatives were friends of, they're on the postage stamps.
That, you know, that's a great thing to say. I really thank you for saying it, because I think we lose sight sometimes in the middle of pressure and conflict of the fact that really in our hearts we wouldn't change place. I wouldn't change places with Schlafly for anything, because she's on the wrong side of history.
Right.
Thanks a lot.
God bless you and keep going.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes. Gloria, I'd really like to just make a statement and see what you say about it, which is about the Teflon-coated presidency. And my statement is this, that we have a president who doesn't go to church, but is a hero of a religions. He hardly sees his children, and from what I hear, doesn't see his grandchildren, but talks family. We have over 50 people in that administration, in the high offices, who have been removed from office because of the very thing that they're talking about, Jerry Ferrer. And it just boggles my mind. I can't believe he makes statements to the Russians and to everybody else. Why, or is it that there's a certain group of people in the United States that belong to I've got mine, now you get yours party, and they really stonewall any, because I've noticed it. I remember it during the Nixon administration, and I'm starting to hear that kind of thing now, that it doesn't matter that he made statements to Russia. It doesn't matter, but they're always from ones who, you know.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for
listening. Ones who have a vested interest against a large group of poor, and you know, the whole disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Give Ms. Steinem a chance to respond.
No, I agree, and you've got a very good list there. I would only add to it that he manages to have the biggest deficit in the history of the country and yet campaign on a constitutional amendment for a balanced budget. I mean, he certainly is wildly inconsistent. I think there are two things going on. One is that there's no logic to oppression. You know, whatever the superior group has is superior and is used as a rationale for continuing that superiority. So to the extent that he represents an economic and a class interest, as you point out, no matter what he said, it would be rationalized and okay. Then the second thing is that we tend, and I'm afraid that my colleagues in the media do this a lot too, we criticize not according to an objective set of or a consistent set of standards, but according to our expectations for that particular person. This finally dawned on me when I was considering, trying to figure out why it was that we didn't know who Nixon was until it was too late and he was already in office, or we didn't know who Robert Kennedy was very well until he was dead and it was already too late. And I think that many people and many reporters loved and respected Robert Kennedy and were ashamed of those personal feelings and thus criticized him even more and held him to a higher standard. Nixon, they mistrusted frequently and were ashamed of that fact, but it, you know, thus held him to a lower standard. So both to conceal their real feelings and relative to, you know, their expectations, they criticized differently. I think Reagan benefits from that enormously. People know he's not that smart. His memory is bad. He never gets his statements straight. He never gets his examples or his statistics right. And they sort of excuse him. And also he is consistent in the sense of whose interests he's serving, you know. So, you know, he does get a lower level of criticism. And I wish that there were on every radio and television station in this country just, you know, a daily 15 minutes of broadcasting nothing but his statements, and he would certainly not be elected.
Do you think that that the press has a similar struggle with some of their trying to resolve some unconscious feelings regarding the first woman vice presidential candidate?
Yeah, I think so. It's what we started out talking about a little, that there's enough consciousness about sexism so that the misgivings or skepticism or hostility is submerged, but then those displaced feelings pop up into an inappropriate intensity someplace else.
On the other hand, couldn't it conceivably be to Geraldine Ferraro's benefit or the Mondale Ferraro ticket benefit that you don't want to carp on anything that might be something that would be sexist, and you'll leave some of those issues that could be seen as rather silly alone.
Well, maybe so, but then all of the free-floating hostility and skepticism gloms onto what is safe, and taxes are safe. And I think that's part of the reason we're seeing a disproportionate response to what seems to be a fairly small problem.
Let's take our next call, and our number is area code 215-923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I wonder if I could ask Ms. Steinem what she thinks Phyllis Schlafly's current strategy is at the Republican convention, and if she would be willing to say a little more about the attitudes of someone like Phyllis Schlafly towards mm-hmm. other women.
Well, perhaps you could tell me what she's been doing at the Republican convention. I only heard her calling for Ferraro's resignation. Was there something else you had in mind?
Well, among other things, she's been trying to trivialize the whole issue of child abuse, saying that the real form of child abuse is what she calls the indoctrination of school children with liberal and humanistic values.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if you have any reactions to this as perhaps part of a whole conservative reaction to the exposures that have happened recently of the extent of child abuse in American society,
mm-hmm.
whether this is perhaps very disturbing to the conservative ideology of what the family is in this country and the way children are treated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. It is all of a piece. For instance, it would seem inconsistent, given the so-called pro-family values, that part of the Reagan platform is the support of the Family Protection Act, which would eliminate all federal laws against child abuse and would forbid federal funding of battered women's shelters and so on. But it's not inconsistent when you understand that the conservative or ultra-right-wing frame of reference is just the reverse of ours. That is, we look at the individual and the individual's relationship to the law. They look at the family and the head of household, that is the man, the sort of patriarchal family structure, as the entity and not the individual. So the law is, in their view, only properly related to the head of household, preferably the man. And any direct relationship or guarantee of rights to children or to women is regarded as anti-family, because that's what they're thinking of. They're thinking of this group, and women and children are essentially owned by the head of household, whereas we're thinking of individuals. So if you... You know, if there was, I'm trying to think of the name of the man who's the head of the, Howard Phillips, that's his name, who's head of the conservative caucus, who gave a speech in which he outlined this very, very well. He's a Harvard-educated right-winger, you know, so he says it very, very clearly. He pointed out that what he called this dreadful trend towards anti-family legislation did not just begin. It started when women were given property rights. and continued when we were allowed to vote, and was continuing with the concepts of children's rights and so on, and would, you know, end with the destruction of Western civilization as we know it. You know, I mean, they are being consistent.
Well, I can understand how a very conservative man would enunciate these principles. The thing that surprises me is the sensitivity of people like Phyllis Schlafly to what is going on in men's minds. Mm-hmm. She seems to feel every bit as threatened by these developments as men do. I wonder if you have had any dealings with her or have any insight into the psychology of a woman.
No, well, I'm only an observer, so, you know, only, you know, I can't know what's in her head and her heart. I would guess, though I don't know, that her experience growing up in which her father left, I believe, and her mother had a very tough time raising her, and then she, Schlafly, married a very well-to-do man and so on, has led her to believe that women can't survive without male protection, and that men, she has just about said, I think, that men are sort of intrinsically irresponsible or evil and have to be compelled by the law to take care, to provide food and whatever for their families. She has a very dyspeptic kind of negative. I mean, if anybody's a man hater, I would say that she is. But this doesn't explain why it is that two people given the same experience can come out in two different directions. For instance, she might equally well say that if there had been equal rights, her mother could have earned enough money to take care of her properly.
Yes.
And yet she didn't. You know, she now, on the other hand, it's not unrealistic, given the world as it is, for her to conclude that you need male protection and that men have to be compelled, you know, to protect you. And that's where she came out.
Well, is there any hope of reaching women like Phyllis Schlafly with that kind of mindset, or is there a certain percentage of the female population that just can never see the equities involved in these issues?
Well, we've all been in various versions of there, you know, so I think we all need to keep talking to each other and reaching out. And, I mean, I certainly spent a long time feeling that professionally at least, the way to success was to get approval from men, because that was the way journalism ran. And, you know, people would say, "You write like a man." I would say, "Oh, thank you," and all that stuff. So we certainly need to keep talking to each other. and there is so much, so many situations in which women as kids, especially, women just grow up with the idea that love and domination come together, that they come to believe they can't be loved unless they are also dominated. It's where masochism comes from. But I think the single best statement I've ever read about why women are right-wing is a book by Andrea Dworkin. It's called Right-Wing Women. I really commend it to you. But she talks about the Happiness of Womanhood woman and Anita Bryant and Schlafly and everybody, and talks about how they have made a bargain. You know, they give up freedom in return for protection. Now, of course, it's a false bargain, because actually the single most dangerous place for a woman from the point of view of violence is not in the street, it's in her own home. But setting that aside, you know, they have made a very specific kind of bargain. Schlafly, she accepts from this. She says that she is the one woman on the right wing who is not acting out of an understandable fear and so on, but is acting duplicitously. That she knows what she's saying isn't true and goes forward and says it anyway as a kind of career step and decision.
My guest is Gloria Steinem, and if you'd like to place a call, our number is area code 215-923-2774. Have you had a chance to see any of the political advertising that's been on recently?
Well, just spottily. What do you think?
Well, I'm thinking of all the family images which are presented. Really strong images of both, like Norman Rockwell painting type things, where you have a field and a setting sun and a nice country house and a family enjoying a barbecue. And it's been both Democratic and Republican. It's been a message projected by both the Democrats and the Republicans. Real strong traditional family values in their advertising. Just wondering what you thought about that image that's
been projected. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, I certainly that was true at the Democratic convention, too. People were using family rhetoric, which, of course, you know, is great, except that you have to make clear what you mean. You know, a family can be a nurturing, freely chosen institution with respect for each other, or it can be a prison and full of violence and so on. So I was a little concerned that the Democrats were not explaining what they meant. For instance, if you say to an audience of women, we are returning to the family, they get depressed. Because what that means is we're returning to a situation in which a lot of them were servants and had to do all the cooking and didn't have that many rights and, you know, so on. If, however, you say we are trying to make democratic families in which there's, you know, a concept of equality and mutual caring and mutual support, then everybody perks up and says that's terrific. And I think if the Democrats want to win, they have to make very clear that what they're talking about is a democratic family.
Let's take the next call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to welcome Gloria back to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
This is an old friend from Toledo days, and I'd be interested in your comment about...
Can you say your name, or would you rather not?
Well, it's all right with me. This is Marvin.
Hi.
Hi. Question. What was your reaction when Geraldine was nominated to the comments that we heard about the women's organizations are really going to have to get out and work hard, because if this doesn't work, if she doesn't make it, it's going to be a long time before another woman gets a chance?
Well, you know, I guess I had a kind of mixed feeling. I mean, I'm worried about a woman on the ticket being scapegoated for the defeat of the ticket.
Right.
And I think that's a real possibility, but I felt much better about it after the initial response to Ferraro was so warm and enthusiastic, and even the New York Times was reduced to calling Mondale Ferraro's running mate and saying that, you know, he would have a hard time even balancing the support of her, much less outshining it. So far, I don't think that the temper of the, you know, what I feel is that if the ticket were to fail, that it would be judged to be Ferraro's fault. Now, you know, if we get more financial problems and more things crop up, or if she makes a major campaigning error, I agree that she's under a magnifying glass, you know, and you get this kind of situation. It's like in any employment, you know, the first one woman is hired, she doesn't do well, and then forever after they say, well, we hired a woman in 1919 and it didn't work out.
Right.
You know, there is that kind of problem. But I don't feel that it's a... I would say it's more like a 45% danger at the moment, not a 60% danger.
Well, as a fan of yours for many years, having this kind of situation develop in the Democratic Party, and I am a Democrat, I was really, really pleased with the situation. And standing on the train platform and hearing all kinds of strange comments like... Well, what if she has to go negotiate with the Russians and she's 7 months pregnant, and there's an incredible amount of flak flying around on a very superficial level.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's great.
Yeah, I do too, and I think the flak is there, no doubt, and we have to recognize that. And there is this notion, you know, that you need, you know, that men are somehow intrinsically more aggressive, which, you know, if I really thought that was true, I would say, well, we ought to have women of chiefs of state all over the world in this, you know, dangerous nuclear age. And clearly it's not true. I mean, it'd be great to have somebody 7 months pregnant negotiating with the Russians. And I'd be loved to have somebody 7 months pregnant on the other side, you know, negotiating with us. They'd have a clearer stake in the future. But I've really felt good about the popular response to her. And for all these years, you know, we've been saying, look, a woman on the right woman, a good woman on the ticket can really be a plus. And it's so great to see that the popular response is there. As usual, people are ahead of their leaders.
Thanks for your call.
And write me a letter and tell me where you are. I'm real glad you called in.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if I could try out an idea that I just thought of last night when thinking about the Geraldine Ferraro-Zaccaro situation, and that was that aside from the misogyny, which is palpable in the attack, there is also this intra-masculine battle going on in which men are showing John Zaccaro and other men like him that a man who lets his wife get too far will be punished.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I think that's a real interesting idea, and it's probably true because Zaccaro says that, especially among older men, he gets a response that is, you know, can't you control your wife? How can you be married to this woman?
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, for instance, that I remember reading about the first suffragist parade in New York, in which Colonel Blood, who was Victoria Woodhull's companion, mm-hmm. was the only man who marched. And he got even more, much more hostility and violence than the women did because he was viewed as a traitor to his class.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what you say may be at work there. You may be exactly right, you know, in the sense that they're after him for his finances for this kind of subterranean reason. That's interesting.
Well, she has to walk on this sort of walk both sides of the line because on the one hand, she, I don't know. Do you think she is... at all fearful, or are her advisors fearful that she might be seen as being too domineering in relationship to her husband's business is her own business? And that
well,
by directing her husband, that could be essentially a turnoff for male voters.
She is in a double bind. I mean, you know you're approaching a true prejudice when you get parallel and opposing reasons justifying the same act.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And she is being told on the one hand that she should be responsible for her husband's business decisions and so on, and on the other hand that, you know, she is a separate person to who.
Well, she's freeloading.
Yeah, right.
She's freeloading off of him. Off
yeah,
his business.
Is she benefiting from? No. I mean, it's a very difficult task, and I think that she has done so far a pretty good job by just describing what her life is really like. I'll tell you who's also doing a great job of their kids. I don't know if you've seen them being interviewed on television, but they are asked all these extraordinarily unfair questions, you know, about, well, you know, it must be a very tough home life, your mother's away all the time, and they just sort of cheerfully reply from real life, well, she's away, but, you know, our father's home, and he's always there at dinner time, and dinner time is a real, you know, time we try to be together, and if our mother isn't there, our father's there, and, you know, they just sort of answer out of real life, which is, of course, reality is the antidote to prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for your call. We have time for one more call, so move to that. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I've always wanted to meet you. I've always wanted to meet you, Gloria.
That means I probably always wanted to meet you.
This is fantastic. My name's Cindy.
Hi.
And I have a question that concerns the family in itself. You know, you were just talking about the Geraldine Ferraro's family and the kids, and it seems like almost as if these days, with a woman being a vice presidential candidate, there's even more stigma on the pressure on the families themselves as far as the mother and the children having to take some kind of backseat opinion next to, say, the head of the household, which is usually male, in how the world's run. It's almost like, in some cases, I've seen families which are more or less, I guess you could say, backwards, where the male is the head of the household, and heaven forbid something should go wrong, all hell breaks loose, and the children and the wife suffer. And then there are other times when men seem to be really afraid of a woman taking a stand for fear they'll lose the pants, they'll lose the status of the head.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's a real threat, or do you think that it's something partially concocted from, I guess, the bugaboos of our mind and the media to keep the lower class, say the children and women, in line?
Mm-hmm. I think it's concocted, don't you? I mean, because... And not only is it concocted, but ultimately it's a burden on the man as well, because then he's supposed to be right all the time and always dominant. And, I mean, you know, it's this impossible kind of John Wayne image of masculinity which ends up producing ulcers and heart attacks. And
well, we can't all be Mercedes McCambridge, you know, as a very strong feminine leader, almost the I guess you could say, someone once told me, the female-male type, the perfect female replacement for John Wayne.
No, we don't want to be imitative. I think what we're trying to do is to each of us, men and women, to be full people. Now, you know, men have had, say, it's as if society took all the human qualities and sort of arbitrarily said, well, 70-75% of these are masculine and only 25 or 30% are feminine. Men have a bigger role and more room to move around, but men are also being deprived of the full range of humanity. And we are each trying to complete ourselves.
Well,
so, it is it is to men's benefit, and it doesn't mean it always seems to me that progress in a way lies in the direction we haven't been. You know, it doesn't lie in outdistancing other people. It lies in the completion of ourselves. So for men, progress may be often being more, you know, closer to their children, more compassionate, more active at home, whatever. Progress for women may be being more active outside the home. It doesn't mean we're trading places. It means that we're completing ourselves. And now we have at least forced the Internal Revenue Service and other institutions to talk about co-heads of households. I mean, there is no longer an obligation to have only one head of household. You can have two. It can be a real partnership. And in a partnership, things go back and forth. One partner knows more about one area of life, another knows more about another. There isn't one person who is the dominant one all the time.
Well, thanks for your call. And I'm sorry to other callers who we didn't have time to get their calls on the air. We have just a few minutes left. I'd like to ask you, get off the subject of electoral politics, ask you about another political question. What did you think of the whole Vanessa Williams affair, how she dealt with it, how the press dealt with it, how the public reacted to it?
Well, you know, the Miss America contest is clearly silly, and the silliness becomes very obvious when you figure what would happen if there were a Mr. America contest that were exactly the same, and you had two contests, one for unmarried men and one for married men, and you had, chaperones for the unmarried. I mean, that's all crazy. But
it's a question you could ask, actually, if the Mr. America was seen to be gay. Mm-hmm. I guess that might get a weird public reaction.
Well, but that's true. But I mean, the Mr. America contest doesn't even exist for openers, and so there's not an emphasis on virginity or sexuality. It's all muscles, which at least has some degree of work involved in, and it's just not the same kind of contest. I thought that Vanessa Williams was about the only thing that could save the Miss America contest value at all, because at least it was becoming racially integrated instead of being Miss White America. But the aside from Guccione, who is, the king of sleaze, and who is, of course, singly benefited from all of this stuff, it seemed to me that the Miss America pageant people were being incredibly duplicitous, because they are punishing her for doing what they encourage women to do, which is to use their bodies to progress and make money and so on.
Did you regret her resignation?
Yeah, I was sort of sorry she didn't fight it, but and bring a lawsuit or do whatever she needed to do. But I can also, I did trust her judgment. You know, she's in the middle of it and she understands what the possibilities are. And maybe it's just not worth the candle, especially since the second person was also a black woman. If the second person had not been a black woman, it might have been different.
You could also make the argument that in addition to Guccione profiting, that the Hugh Hefner profited a little bit in terms of his own PR, because he was able to say, hey, we rejected the photographs. We wouldn't print that in Playboy. How did you feel about that?
I know. I thought it was really interesting to me that Guccione is the one person alive who seems to make Hefner look good. But I had heard that they rejected the photographs just because they were not high enough quality, and also because Hefner or whoever there is threatened by lesbianism. You know, they don't want to say that women could be as in love with each other as they are with men. I don't know if that's true or not. You know, I hasten to say I don't have this on any authority, but that's the sort of magazine industry gossip, of why they rejected it. But what cheered me up was the kind of person on the street, telephone in response, because it all seemed very commonsensical. And her neighbors and everybody, were saying, look, it's a dumb contest and she has a right to stay there if she wants to. And Guccione is a jerk and we wish her well and we hope, So I think, the popular response was pretty good. And I hope that she has a good career. She has a wonderful singing voice and a great presence and leads a good life. And maybe the Miss America contest will just wither away.
Well, along with the election that we've been talking about in the past, also coming up in the fall is a new TV season. And one of the shows that will be coming up, which is being renewed, is Cagney and Lacey. And could you say a little bit about the involvement of Ms. Magazine in that show?
Yeah, I wish somebody, if there are any journalists listening, they ought to write the story of Cagney and Lacey. I think it's really interesting. We got sort of involved in that story in a zigzag way because our managing editor heard that this script existed when it was they were trying to make it a television movie. There was no hope that it might be a series, only a movie. And even so, it took 6 years for these two women authors of this script to get it on, because there had never been two women on television who worked together. There had been one woman among men, or two women fighting with each other, but not two women who were colleagues in the sort of Sundance Kid kind of way before. So it took them 6 years to get this movie on. So when we heard that, we put it on. We did a story about it. We put it on the cover of Ms. And we said, "Look, watch this show to our readers. And you know, if you like it, if you think it should be a series, write to CBS and tell them so." Well, they got this flood of letters. So it became, against the will, you know, and the planning of the network, it became a series. Then it's gone through incredible and unprecedented ups and downs since it's been canceled. Then more letters came flooding in. It was put back. It was canceled again. It was put back. I mean, it is a tribute to the power of the watcher, except it's also depressing because it shows how distant some of the decision makers are from knowing what the viewer really, really wants to see. I'm not saying it's your all-time perfect television show, but at least it is breaking boundaries, and it is showing these two very different women who are friends, who are loyal to each other, who support each other, and who do their jobs well.
Well, it's been fun to have you back on Fresh Air. Thanks.
Well, it's fun for me too, and it's a tribute to this program and to Terry, to you know, to everything about it, that you have such great people calling in. I mean, you know, of all the call-in shows I've ever been on, this is always the most interesting.
Well, thank you, and thanks to our listeners for providing that type of participation.